Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. And Halloween continues as guest Esther Ludlow drops in to talk to me about Mel Brooks' 1974 love letter to Universal Horror, Young Frankenstein.
It's coming from the deep, dark recesses of the mind of Mel Brooks. I love him. Young Frankenstein.
Can you hear me? Give my creation life!
This guy means business.
Young Frankenstein.
Oh dear, nothing left. What shall we throw in now?
The creation of the monster and film known as Young Frankenstein started with actor Gene Wilder, who was coming off a string of flops that included two of his most legendary works, The Producers and Willy Wonka. Around 1972, Wilder started dabbling with the concept of continuing the Frankenstein story that had originally been laid out with James Whale's two early 1930s features and the 1939 film Son of Frankenstein. The actor had little experience with screenwriting. He had written a few scripts, but they went unproduced and were, according to Wilder himself, not particularly good. His agent brought up the idea of working alongside two rising stars, Peter Boyle and Marty Feldman, and Wilder soon sent them some of the scenes that he had laid out. He was then asked to consult director Mel Brooks about helming the feature. The problem? Wilder had already done that. He had sought Brooks out and gave him two pages of the script. Brooks' response? It was cute, but he wasn't too keen on helming work he didn't write himself. When Wilder and Brooks re-teamed on Blazing Saddles, the actor asked Brooks to give the film another look. Because of the string of familial films about that had already come out, Brooks just didn't think there was any merit towards continuing the series. But it wasn't until Gene Wilder pointed out that his character, Frederick Frankenstein, or Frankenstein, didn't want anything to do with his infamous family that Brooks finally decided to jump aboard.
Dr. Frankenstein.
Frankenstein.
You're putting me on.
No, it's pronounced Frankenstein.
Do you also say Frederick?
No, Frederick.
Well, why isn't it Frederick Frankenstein?
It isn't, it's Frederick Frankenstein.
I see.
You must be Igor.
No, it's pronounced Igor.
But they told me it was Igor.
Well, they were wrong then, weren't they?
Brooks had modest plans for the film, but the studios didn't think the budget needed to be that high. With just $2.5 million to make the movie, Brooks returned to working with people he'd had success with in the past, which included Wilder and Blazing Saddles actress Madeline Kahn. The script was pretty much redundant, with many of the actors ad-libbing and improvising their scenes. The film was a box office success and scored Oscar nominations for Best Sound and Adapted Screenplay. Cloris Leachman and Kahn would be nominated for Golden Globes for Best Actress and Supporting Actress, respectively. Like Brooks' The Producers, Young Frankenstein traveled to the Great White Way as a musical, winning 3 Tonys and running for 2 years between 2007 and 2009. After the break, guest Esther Ludlow joins me to put on the Ritz with Young Frankenstein.
Hit it!
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits?
In the leaf!
Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes, or cutaway coat, perfect fits.
In the leaf!
Dressed up like a $1 million trooper, trying mighty hard to look like Gary Cooper.
Okay, listeners, spooky Halloween episode number 2 starts off with my guest for this week. I am talking to the amazing Esther Ludlow. Esther, how are you today?
I'm great.
Thank you so much for joining me on this episode to talk about Mel Brooks' Young Frankenstein. But Esther, in case people don't know who you are, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
My podcast, Once Upon a Crime, is a true crime podcast. I tell stories. Basically, it's a storytelling podcast, and they just happen to be true stories about crime. It's not a discussion podcast. I script it, I write it, I research it, and I tell you the story from beginning, middle, and end. And I also group it into kinds of crimes. So what, you know, might be 4 episodes episodes on kidnappings, 4 episodes on kids who are killers, 4 episodes on women who kill, and it runs in a series that way.
Yeah, if you are not listening to Once Upon a Crime, you should, because it's amazing and also frightening, and it's probably more frightening than any of the things that we'll talk about today, because we're talking about a comedy. But of course, we are talking about the 1974 film Young Frankenstein, so not necessarily true crime, but based in film histories. It's the kind of a sequel continuation of the Frankenstein films originated by James Wales in the early 1930s with Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, ended in 1939 with Son of Frankenstein, which if you listened to last year's Halloween episode, Todd and I did a 3-episode podcast talking about all 3 Frankenstein films. So this is a really great return. It tells the story of Gene Wilder's character, Dr. Frederick Frankenstein, or Frankenstein. He's trying to distance himself from his father and grandfather's past. So essentially, this is a sequel to Son of Frankenstein, starting right where things left off. Decides to continue the work laid out in the original films, creates a creature played by Peter Boyle, and the rest of the film plays out pretty much like the series of films that you might have seen before. Now, Esther, you suggested this. So what is your history with this film in terms of when you saw it, how it's changed as you've grown up, all of that?
I'll go a little bit backwards. So it's a tradition in our house. And I don't even know why this started, but one Halloween night when, you know, we're sitting around waiting for trick-or-treaters, we put on the movie Young Frankenstein. I had always loved Young Frankenstein, and I had owned a copy of it. So I put the movie on Young Frankenstein during that Halloween night, and we've done it ever since. My kids right away decided that was a thing. So as soon as we know trick-or-treaters are going to start coming, we'll put on Young Frankenstein. We'll be watching it while we're handing out candy. So I've been doing it for years. So I see it at least once a year, but usually more than that. Actually, I'm old enough to remember seeing it in the theater. When I was a kid, we had in the little town that I lived in, we had at one cinema and there was 2 screens. On Saturdays, my parents, my mother, my father, whatever, would drop off me and my brother, and we would watch the movie. Sometimes we'd watch, you know, it used to be a double feature, but sometimes we'd watch it more than once. Like we'd watch first movie and we'd just stay there all day. And, you know, because your friends went and everybody, it was just a kid's hangout was the movies. And now we don't always pay attention to the movie. Sometimes it was just, we were just there to hang out. But when Young Frankenstein came out, it was different. It was funny. It was hilarious. And at that time, I think maybe, I don't remember exactly how old I was. I know I was a preteen. I remember because I was really into like monster movies and all that stuff. You know, the Saturday morning or the Sunday morning movies would come out on television and they'd be the original Frankenstein, Dracula, all of that stuff. So I was really into it. So when that came out, it was like the best thing ever because not only was it looked like the old movies that we loved, but it was so hilarious. It was so funny. And there was just, I mean, joke after joke after joke, but set in this really creepy looking Frankenstein lab and all this. So it was awesome. I just loved it. So ever since then, I've been a fan of it. And when we got to the point where you can actually buy video, I went out and got that because that was one of my favorite movies.
Young Frankenstein phenom is interesting to me. I came to this movie. This is one of many movies that I saw late in life. So I always wonder what would have happened if I had seen this as a child. Oddly enough, the Mel Brooks movie that I saw as a child that I enjoyed was his other take on classic Universal horror character, which was Dracula Dead and Loving It. Probably not nearly as sharp and dedicated to detail as Young Frankenstein is, but it still tries to emulate the original Dracula in some ways, not nearly as lovingly homaged as this film. But that's the film that I came to that got me into Mel Brooks. Watching this as an adult, having seen all the other Frankenstein films previously, having seen this movie homaged in other films, you really lose a little something. This is like, to me, watching Star Wars for the first time. I saw Star Wars very late in life. And having seen so many movies do their own take on Star Wars, you lose a little something going back to the source material at that point. I've seen this 3 times now, and I still appreciate it for what Brooks was able to accomplish, but I always feel like I'm missing something. This is considered one of the funniest movies of all time. I feel like I'm missing something that keeps me from saying, yes, yes, it is. And I don't know what that could be. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think. I don't know what it could be. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love everything about this movie, the cast, the attention to detail, the individual moments. This is a lot like if you listen to my episode on An American I was going to say an American Werewolf in London, American in Paris. Uh-huh. That's another movie where I'm just like, I'm missing something. I am not understanding the blind adoration for this movie. I don't know. I don't know if you have suggestions on what that could be, but I feel like I should have seen this when I was younger.
I think there's two different kinds of sensibilities. It's, you have to really, really like stupid humor. I mean, because there's some really stupid humor in this. And I guess maybe because I did see it as a child, you know, when you're a child, you love stupid humor. Cornier the joke, the better. I guess more sophisticated jokes in it, but a lot of it is, well, it's Mel Brooks. So it's very campy. It's very campy. And if you like that kind of thing, you just tend to keep getting pleasure out of these same corny jokes over and over. It was a big thing. I remember when I was like 8, 9, 10 years old, all of the old horror movies were so, I mean, we were all into it. Like me and my cousins, we would stay up late and watch those movies. I don't know. I think it's that may have skipped a generation because there's so much more out there now. You know, there's like Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th and all of those that they might have known more than, you know, some of the very old movies. And so when they look back at these old movies, it's like, oh God, those are so fake. But that's the fun of it. The fun of it is it is so cheesy because we're so much more sophisticated than that in filmmaking now with all the effects. And to me, it's a throwback. It's a throwback to just enjoying a very simple and also very story-driven. You're talking about all the other Frankenstein movies, and those are very story-driven. I mean, if you've read the original Mary Shelley book, it follows it pretty closely. And so if you don't have a history with a novel or the old campy, you know, cheesy movies that were very simple and story-driven, I think that you may miss some of that. At least, you know, some of the much younger people may think, oh, yeah, it's cute, but it's not that great. That kind of thing.
Well, you bring up an interesting point, the communal aspect of this movie. And I felt that really plays out with a lot of movies, particularly from the 70s. When I went to the Turner Classic Movies Film Festival this year, I ended up in a screening of Dr. Strangelove. I'd seen Dr. Strangelove numerous times, and I said the same thing. I understand what it's trying to say. I understand why it was important during that time period, but it does nothing for me as a comedy. Mm-hmm. I didn't laugh. And watching that movie with a theater full of people who were all laughing at all the jokes, I got it. I don't know what it is to me, and somebody could say that this wasn't limited to the 70s, this was limited to the 80s or beyond, that you really need that theatrical experience. Yeah. With some of these movies. You need to have everybody validating that it's humorous. It's like watching a silent film. You watch a Harold Lloyd movie from the 1920s, and watching that alone is probably the worst thing you can do, not only because it's silent, but because you're missing a lot of the communal elements of just hearing other people laugh at things you might not notice. I'm very tempted to try to find a way to see this with a theater, because I think that that would really help a lot. We should give some context, because I find this to be interesting. This was Mel Brooks' second movie of 1974 alone. He did this at the end. Oddly enough, this was not a Halloween film. This was a December release. Release dates were very weird before Jaws. You didn't have the summer movie season. You didn't have these blocks of film releases that we do now. Earlier in the year, in February, Mel Brooks had Blazing Saddles. A very weird movie to me, because when I saw it the first time, I thought this was going to be like a hard R, crazy, weird, R-rated curse fest. And it's not. It's a PG movie. Mm-hmm. It's very tame. As you mentioned, the jokes are very juvenile. And really, the harshest joke line is like sex joke. Having seen Blazing Saddles and watching this, how do you feel knowing that Mel Brooks was able to go from one to the other? Because to me, those two, I mean, they both feel like a Mel Brooks movie, but they feel like he was just on opposite ends of the spectrum, rightfully so.
Brought up another movie that I love. I remember watching that one too. And I remember going to the movies with my father to see that movie when it came out in the theater. And my dad loved Westerns, and he would watch, you know, the Westerns on television and Gunsmoke and all these old shows. And it was one of these things. I was like, oh, let's go to the movies. I'm like, okay, you know, whatever. I went for the popcorn. My dad laughed so hard. I mean, I just loved it. It was so great just to see that. It was such a stupid, again, stupid humor, but so funny. And yeah, very different. But also, they're both very Mel Brooks. Mel Brooks, when you see a Mel Brooks movie, you know this has got to be a Mel Brooks movie. And especially since most of the time he's in it, at least in a cameo. So that was one of those that, again, it's just one joke after another after another. The sex jokes are kind of, you know, double entendre. I mean, it's very much that there's, and it brings in a lot of things you think about, they're never brought out, they're never mentioned in specifically, like you had the gang of thieves and they look horrible and they're dirty and they're disgusting, and he has them lining up and telling what all their specialties in crime are. It's like, yeah, I rob and I rape and I pillage and, and they're like, okay, you know, next kind of thing. The fact that the sheriff ends up being a black man. I don't even know where this town was supposed to be. And then the racism comes out and it's like, wow. But they do it in a way that is funny against the people who are racist. And it brings out that. But these are things that are never talked about in these, or weren't talked about in these films. And so Mel Brooks, he's very cutting edge in that way.
You bring up a great thing, which even though Mel Brooks has made comments that are a little tone deaf in terms of how he feels that Blazing Saddles would never be made today because people are quote unquote too PC. The point that I think people, and at least why I think Blazing Saddles might be better than this movie, is that it's a satire. It's a satire of the Western genre. He's pointing out how Westerns created this certain myth that excluded African Americans, and he's pointing out how wrong that is. And it's funny because he's taking this genre that is so ingrained in the very fabric of our country and poking at it. That's not to say that his loving attempts of film genres, which, you know, you have this, you have High Anxiety, which is a spoof on Hitchcock, all his other movies. I mean, I love that he loves to spoof these movies, but none of them are as pointed as Blazing Saddles, maybe because there's really no grander political thing you can say. You know, you can't watch the original Frankenstein and say, oh, well, you know, what's the subtext there?
Right.
You can read Mary Shelley's book and see subtext, but you can't really see it in the movies. It's not like King Kong, where you can argue that it's about slavery. So in that regard, I think he loses a little something in comparison to Blazing Saddles. But there was a bizarre Frankenstein love back in the mid-70s, because you had this and then Rocky Horror Picture Show in 75. Which is also Frankenstein influenced. Mm-hmm. And I'm not understanding what was going on in the mid 70s where everybody was really big on Frankenstein, but apparently a good year or two.
You know, and I don't know, but I remember vaguely I had a younger cousin who was a couple years younger than me, and he used to collect, I don't know if they were models or some kind of figures. They were all the monsters, especially Frankenstein during that time. You're right. It was a thing. Like, he had all these Frankenstein models. Know what was going on. To tell you the truth, I don't remember, but you're right. There was definitely something going on around that time with the Frankenstein
monster. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it was having to deal with the fact that it's man and creating life and how that deals with the politics. If somebody has a theory, feel free to send me an email, because I find that to be really, really bizarre. We brought up originally that this is tribute to the original Frankenstein films. Esther, have you seen the original trio?
Gosh, it was so long ago. But yeah, I mean, I think I've seen the original more currently, which still would have been a while ago. But the other ones, gosh, I must have been a little kid when I saw that, like in reruns on my grandma's house or something. But yeah, I do remember seeing those.
This is a pretty much a loving tribute to all three, which I noticed. There's slight references to Son of Frankenstein. The Kenneth Mars character is probably the most overt connection to that. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we're supposed to believe that Frederick is the son of Basil Rathbone's character from the third film. But it's mostly just remaking first Frankenstein. You have a very similar plot line with Frederick going to create this man. He has a fiance named Elizabeth. All of that's from the first film. And what I appreciate about this movie is that it's black and white. He got the same set designer from the James Whale films. And really, he uses it to show this stupidity around science, how people stumble into creating things and man's legacy. So for me, I like that it's the unofficial capper to the three James Whale films, even though the tone couldn't be different. I think this, if anything, watched a lot of Bride of Frankenstein, because if anybody's seen Bride of Frankenstein, the tone of that movie is both darker and at the same time very campy.
Yes.
Ernst Thesiger, who plays Dr. Pretorius, is just very florid. So you get a reference to Bride here, again, with the Madeline Kahn character, but I love how it's really mixing all three movies. And I would even say a little bit of King Kong, because there's the putting on the Ritz scene always feels to me like the showing off of Kong in New York. I don't know why. I don't know if that was an intentional. But how do you feel about the homage aspect of it?
Mel Brooks must have been a big fan of all of those three movies. As a matter of fact, when I was reading up about some of the behind the scene things on it, that he actually used electrical machinery kind of stuff, the same ones that were used in the Universal Frankenstein films. And the guy that made those was still alive, and he contacted him, and the guy, he still had this stuff stored in his garage. So he was able to take that and actually use it in the film, give him credit for it, because apparently from the original, he didn't get credit.
That was very common. The below the line tech guys usually didn't see any credit. And it always makes me smile and makes me sad to think that a lot of the props from these 1930s movies ended up in somebody's house.
Yeah, I know, and then
you always wonder what happened to them after that. You hear the strange story about like rare treasure trove of silent film being found in somebody's attic. Not a lot of classic film props left over in somebody's house.
You got to imagine they ended up in somebody's garage. It was somebody's grandpa or great grandpa. And then when you know, they passed, they just, you know, oh, get rid of this junk. We don't know what it is or something. And it's just, oh, no, you know, that should have been in a museum or something.
And we haven't talked about it as much on the show, but the state of the fact that there is no proper Hollywood museum, Motion Picture Academy of Arts and Sciences is trying to do one, taken a long, long, long time, but they are supposedly moving forward with one. And Debbie Reynolds tried for a long time to get a museum because she was one of the biggest memorabilia people out there.
That's amazing, once again, they don't have, and I can't believe that. That's crazy.
Let's start breaking down some of the cast, because I think if anything, the story is pretty much set. It's an homage to Frankenstein. But what differentiates this is the cast. Gene Wilder plays Frederick Frankenstein. This was Gene Wilder's first success at the time because The Producers, which was his other film with Mel Brooks, and Willy Wonka, which had come out in 1972, despite the fact that they are now considered classics, were flops at the time. And this was his first major film success. I love him. I love him in everything, but I think he's best. You watch him in The Producers, it's a character that's very reliant on him being annoying and shrill. Here, though, he's very nuanced. He's got the comedic timing down pat. He's got this ability to be very calm 1 minute, and then it turns into high drama the second. Like when he tells them to lock him in the room with the creature, he's totally going to tame the savage beast. And he says, I'm totally okay. They close the door. He takes one look at the creature and turns around. He's like, let me out now. He starts having this conniption. It is hilarious. How do you feel about Gene Wilder as an actor and in this film?
I love Gene Wilder. Yeah, you're right. He's one of these people that can play such an odd character and yet most normal person in the room.
And he's the only one not putting on like a fake accent or weird makeup or effects or anything like that.
Yeah, just an odd character. I love the opening scene. He's teaching the room, I guess, as medical students about the brain. And he's so professional. And then he brings in the subject to experiment on. And he lets out the craziest curse words to try to get this guy to react. And like you said, it just changes his character from being this super professional to this crazy man. And the thing that I always crack up about that scene is you're supposed to be in like this, almost like a medical theater kind of thing where everybody's watching him talk about brain and, you know, going and all the medical students are in their white lab coats and they're taking their notes and stuff. And yet he is teaching the most basic information about the brain that I like learned in high school or junior high. You know? Like that always makes me laugh. I'm like, really? Come on. Because he's like, you know, talking about the parts of the brain, the medulla oblongata. And it makes me laugh every time because I'm like, this is not a medical school subject to be teaching. This is crazy. But of course, got to play for a wide audience. But I just always find that so funny. And he's doing it with such seriousness that it just kills me.
Well, and it's funny to compare that to a scene that Mel Brooks ends up ripping off from himself. In Dracula Dead Loving It, he does a very similar sequence involving a medical school, medical students, and it's Mel Brooks. He's playing the Van Helsing character, and he's teaching these students about anatomy. And so night and day to watch both of them, because watching Gene Wilder do it, it is like a masterclass of comic timing. And watching Mel Brooks do it as himself, it's more reliant on gross out humor because, you know, there's like an actual brain being thrown at somebody. It really loses something because you need a performer
mm-hmm. who is not just going to... Mel Brooks needs the gross out gags. He needs the prop. Gene Wilder doesn't need props. He is the prop.
Yeah. Exactly.
And I think that that's what's hilarious. When he being asked all these questions about his family and he's becoming increasingly more irritated and then proceeds to stab himself in the leg with a scalpel. Mm. People for years thought that Gene Wilder actually stabbed himself because of how unscripted and ad-libbed that feels. And I mean, much of the movie is ad-libbed. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to see why people would be taken by that, because I've seen this movie 3 times. I still gasp because it's unexpected to me that he's going to do that. And I think that that's how you know that he's perfect for the role. And he just looks, if you watch the original, the first two Frankensteins, not the third because Basil Rathbone is very polished, but the Colin Clive character or even the Renfield character in Dracula, you know, Gene Wilder with the wild hair and the mustache, he doesn't feel like he's from 1974.
No.
He feels like he could have been in 1934, which I really appreciate because I think a lot of movies that try to homage today, you really lose something in how people look. You know, they just don't seem like they fit in that time period. And Gene Wilder does. We have to throw it out to our creature, in this case, played by Peter Boyle. I don't know if you agree with this, but I always feel like Frankenstein himself seems very, very superfluous in this movie. He's got a couple good scenes, but really it's Wilder's film. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, totally. I totally would. I mean, and I do think that now Peter Boyle to me is Frankenstein just because I've seen this so many times, but he's a different kind of Frankenstein. I don't even know what you would call him.
It's not like Karloff. You know, Karloff, the Frankenstein character took a lot of changes, even in the 3 movies you've seen. And I have not seen the, you know, the Abbott and Costello, all of those type of takes on the character. But Frankenstein, the first movie, starts out as this dead-eyed, silent figure trying to master language, which he does master in the second film. And then in the third film, because Karloff was just done playing the character, he goes back to this lumbering, stupid behemoth figure, undoes everything from the first 2 films. So in this case, I think Boyle is going more for that than the more nuanced first 2 iterations. Although his funniest scene to me is taken from the first Frankenstein. It's the scene with him and Gene Hackman. Gene Hackman plays the blind man, which is probably one of the sweetest scenes in the first film. And it's a beautifully written section in the Shelley novel, kind of lumbers into this guy's house. And he proceeds to be assaulted by fire and other horrible things because the blind man is blind. Yes, is it low humor making fun of blindness? Yes, it is. It's really taking back that belief that the Frankenstein creature is this character who only brings like violence and aggression. Mm-hmm. And in this instance, he has aggression and violence unwittingly bestowed upon him.
The fact that this is Gene Hackman has always blown my mind. That plays this small character in this Mel Brooks film. The funniest lines in the movie is at the very end when he's calling him back and he's like, I was going to make espresso.
Please.
And that was actually ad-libbed by Hackman. And that's hilarious to me because I thought that was just such a great line.
And they had to cut away because people were laughing.
It's almost very vaudeville in it, you know, the way it feels. Just everything that keeps happening to this guy. He's just sitting there and, like you said, being caught on fire and being burned by hot soup and whatever else was going on.
Well, and I also have to throw out the Maria scene, one of the more infamous scenes in the first feature film, had Frankenstein throw a small child into a lake and then watch her drown. In this movie, he stumbles upon a little girl and you think he's going to throw her down a well. The humor is more from the fact that her parents are in the house asking where she is. Totally horrible parents think, you know, did you check upstairs? Well, I thought you did. They're sitting in the same spot for like 15 minutes discussing how their daughter has probably been horribly murdered. Culminates with her accidentally being flung off of a seesaw into her bedroom. I mean, those are the little things where if you watch the original films, you get why those are funny and creative. I would love to see somebody who had never seen Frankenstein just ever and see how that would play. How do you feel about the scene everybody loves? The putting on the Ritz moment.
I mean, when I remember when I first watched it, and even to this day, it feels like it's so out of place in this movie. What is going on here? I get the point of the gag and everything, but this was a scene that really didn't fit at all in this movie. And it really distracted me from everything else that was going on. It was a little bit too much over the top. And it's one of my least favorite scenes because I just don't see how it fits.
You know, in a movie that really plays with time, and I say kind of because even though Gene Wilder looks like he could be from 34, Terry Garr wears clothes that look like they're from 1974.
Yeah.
They do not look period specific. And this scene, yeah, it could be. And I know that, again, the producers was their big collaboration, Brooks and Wilder, before this. So it almost feels like they might be trying to call back to that a little bit. It's funny. You know, I mean, I love having Gene Wilder sing, especially after Willy Wonka. I'd love to know what he thought about having to do another musical moment after that film had flopped. But yeah, you're right. It doesn't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the thing. Like, it doesn't lead into a big climax. That's where I think it feels like King Kong, because if you recall King Kong, they're showing off the creature and then he gets loose and it leads to the finale. This, it just happens. And yes, it does end with the two characters at odds, but it just doesn't go anywhere for me. You can send your "you don't get why putting on the Ritz is hilarious" emails to me, and I will try to be a converted person. I don't know. We have to talk about Marty Feldman, who plays Igor, who is my favorite character of the whole movie. He's probably, as much as Gene Wilder, is the smartest man in the narrative of the film. I think Marty Feldman is the smartest person in reality because he's the character that's always bringing up the fact that it is a movie. I think a lot of his jokes are calling out the fact that he knows this is a film. The way he pokes at Madeline Kahn's character when she's introduced, or concept of him taking hump and moving it back and forth throughout the whole movie, which Marty Feldman had been doing this the entire time. And only at a certain point did people realize it, and then they wrote it into the script. So for me, I always appreciate that he really is telling the audience, like, you know, this is a film, right? You know, you're watching a movie. This is all BS. He really sends up the breaks the fourth wall without directly commenting on it.
Dr. Frankenstein's talking about how he's going to do this with grace and dignity and everything after that. He can't bring the monster back to life. And then he has a freak out and he's crying and screaming and why me? And then at the end he says, and Marty Feldman just looks at the camera and says, grace and dignity. Yeah.
You know, like, well, he's like the one that really sets the plot in motion because he drops the brain and brings back the brain of Abby Normal. I love how Marty Feldman, everything is said with a wink and a nod to the camera. Mm-hmm. I have to bring up my big question, which is Mel Brooks, I think, might have a woman problem. And I know immediately people are going to roll their eyes and say, well, it was 1974. I get that. But this is really something that he hasn't fixed at all. I love Madeline Kahn. Mm-hmm. I love her. I think she's one of the funniest women comedians that we ever had, and we will probably never see her like again. I think she is fantastic in this film. She gets to sing. She gets to be petty. She gets to have all these great moments. But I hate how Mel Brooks writes women. I like her character in Blazing Saddles because it seems like Mel Brooks has a bit of a hold on what he wants to say, which is that women during the Western time period, while usually playing prostitutes, just had to be tired from their chronic day job. Like, I get that. That says something. As Elizabeth, she's just kind of the nag. Mm-hmm. She's the self-obsessed, fashion-focused woman who you never really believe the Gene Wilder's character. Well, you would never believe Madeline Kahn would give Gene Wilder's character the time of day. She has some great moments where they're trying to be romantic and intimate, and she's just worried about her clothes. But I don't know. She just always seems like she's playing the shrew. I mean, that was something common for Madeline Kahn. She always played these cold, standoffish women. And it bothers me in this. I don't know if it bothers you.
Yeah, I mean, she's definitely is that. You know, she's the one that's all about her looks and all about, you know, status. And there's a big thing as far as the fact that, you know, she's dating or engaged to this doctor. Obviously, she looks like she came from money. It's all of that. And then, of course, you juxtapose that against Inga, who's just this simple peasant girl.
She's fun.
Yeah.
She's the guy's girl, you know, and she's also the more sexually open character.
And she's part of the team. She's part of the team in the lab. And Madeline Kahn, then her character, Elizabeth, it changes her when she meets the monster. Still at the end, very end, plays like, okay, she's just this naggy wife telling you, don't forget to do this, don't forget to do that, you need to take your whatever. It's like back to her original role.
The Inga character is, she's one of the boys. Terry Garr is fine. I don't have a lot of problems. She's the buxom, looks like a St. Pauli girl character that you would kind of expect in these types of, I would say, more exploitation takes on this movie. But yeah, the Madeline Kahn performance always bothers me because Madeline Kahn tended to play that. She did this too in a Peter Bogdanovich movie called What's Up, Doc, where she played kind of a naggy character. She didn't like it.
Never. I loved What's Up, Doc. That was another one I watched when I was a kid.
She's the best. Yeah, she's the best part of that movie for me. But here, I always have an issue with the fact that her change, quote unquote, comes about by a scene, and we just talked about this last episode with how movies didn't really, and I know consent was not a thing that we did not discuss back in 74, but it ends up with a quasi, is it assault? I don't really know.
Yeah, it's really straddling that line there, definitely.
She's changed, essentially, she's changed by sex. Or is she? Not really, because the movie ends with Mel Brooks saying, don't ever get married because marriage is death. So I don't know how I feel about Madeline Kahn in this role. She's great.
Yeah.
I just wish the script was better for her. And originally, Madeline Kahn and Terry Garr wanted the other role. Kahn wanted to play Inga, and Terry Garr wanted to play Elizabeth. And then Madeline Kahn decided that she wanted to play Elizabeth, and Terry Garr just kind of got Inga by default. I have to wonder how that would have been different.
It would have been very different.
Would Madeline Kahn have still been allowed to play Inga as this fun, flighty sex pot? If she had, I think we would have gotten something similar to her role in like Paper Moon, which is my favorite Madeline Kahn movie. I don't know. I always get bothered by that. Again, somebody can tell me that I'm just being mean unnecessarily, but I always wish Madeline Kahn got a little bit more respect in this movie. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the ending and whether this is the funniest movie of all
time. One more thing, though, before as far as the cast. Because you just have to say this word. Frau Blücher. You need to talk about Frau Blücher.
Yes, we got to talk about Cloris Leachman, too, before
that
we
was, like, the best whole scene when she keeps saying her name and the horses keep whinnying. Oh, my God.
Exactly. Yeah, Cloris Leachman is so great. And she kind of disappears at a certain point in this movie. But she's so funny playing this character that if you've seen any type of haunted house film from the 40s, the character that you always are assuming is going to be evil. And even though she has her motivations for letting the monster free, because Frederick's grandfather was her boyfriend, she's not malicious. She's not an evil character. She offers him Ovaltine at a certain point, which is a hilarious little ad-lib on Cloris Leachman's part. And I like that as much as I complain about Madeline Kahn being one note and the nag, Cloris Leachman gets to have a very nuanced take on the villain.
I loved her. And I mean, she could have been totally just, you know, pushed to the side. And that's nobody, is just somebody who's caretaker. But they is a really big part of the, like you said, the plot, why this happened and who she was, you know, originally grandfather and all of that. So there was quite a bit going on with her character that a few scenes in that movie.
We talked about the ending somewhat. How do you feel about the ending? How do we feel about the happy marriage ending for everybody?
It's kind of a campy ending. Oh, okay, here it is. It's kind of cute and it's kind of fun. And, you know, that's all there is to it. And you see the monster in the smoking jacket and reading the paper. You find out his kind of changed roles with Victor Frankenstein because of, you know, what happened when they were bringing him back. I mean, I guess it ties it all up in a bow.
It does. Way. And and I think in comparison to how dark the 70s, I mean, I think people forget how bleak 70s movies were. Not a lot of movies ended happily in the 70s. And this is one of the few that ends very nicely with the couples paired off and everybody gets what they want, except for, I'm assuming, Igor and Frau Blücher, who we don't really know what they got at the end. In contrast to the rest of the decade, ends with everything very nicely. Would you say this is the funniest movie of all time?
I actually think Blazing Saddles might be funnier. But
it is.
And I love that one, too. It has its charm for me. Like I said, you know, it's become a tradition and it's something that my kids know every line and every scene. And so, yeah. So I think that's the place that it kind of has in my heart.
Yeah, I would agree. Blazing Saddles, I think, is funnier, if only because Mel Brooks is trying to make a point. This, I feel, it's a great homage. But I think that's all it is an homage. I do think it's very funny. I just think that it loses something in today's 2017 day and age of watching movies predominantly alone in your house. I think we forget how isolating movie watching can be nowadays with so many options. It's sad that I have to say that Young Frankenstein loses a little something just as it ages, if only because the atmosphere of watching films changes and you really need the atmosphere of that time period to appreciate it. Listeners, you can send me your thoughts about Young Frankenstein or tell me why you're no longer listening to the podcast because I didn't like this movie at ticklishbiz@gmail.com. Once again, I would like to thank Esther Ludlow for taking time out today. Where can fans get in touch and learn more about you?
So you can, of course, look for the podcast anywhere you find podcasts. It's Once Upon a Crime. You can also follow me on Twitter at Upon a Crime. You can find me on Facebook and Instagram at Once Upon a Crime Pod.
I don't know if you want to give a little sneak peek over the next week or two in case you want to throw that out there.
Well, we actually just finished a series or finishing a series. They'll probably be getting this about the same time yours comes out. It's called With Friends Like These, where there's actual crimes that are one friend commits against another friend. And then if we are done with that, then we're going into the next series on fakes, frauds, and liars. And I'll just leave it at that. They'll be surprised at which cases I pick to fit into that series.
Well, listeners, definitely give that a listen.
That closes out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio and Player FM, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please consider helping the podcast out by giving a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. Want to listen to episodes early or have me review your favorite film? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast. If you're interested in becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Next time, our third spooky Halloween episode is released, as I'm joined by Ansley Gordon to talk about our favorite old Hollywood murder mysteries. Till next time.